This is a production of Cornell University.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back from the holiday break. Hope all of you had an enjoyable time being with family, friends, all that good stuff. And I'm excited that we've got some really interesting guests joining us today. Laura Beth Santakos, who will be talking about the Intervene program. And we have Mary Beth Grant, who's going to be discussing the work of the Sorority and Fraternity Judicial Review Committee. And then finally, we have some guests from Dining. Dustin Cutler, who's the director of Dining, will be coming by, and they're going to be introducing a new meal plan that you all and all of our colleagues will hopefully be able to take advantage of here in the near future. Couple of quick announcements after we, first of all, I guess we'll approve the minutes from the last meeting. Is there a motion to approve the minutes? Is there a second?
Second.
All right, anybody opposed? Great. Minutes are approved. A couple quick announcements. I've sent an email out yesterday. Hopefully it was relatively clear, kind of the path forward with regards to the staff discussions. Hey and I met with Linda and Ruth yesterday, and it's going to be exciting. I think that the energy that they're going to bring to our evaluation of the comments we've received so far from the staff discussions, as well as those comments that we'll be getting in the next six events, their expertise and advice is, I think, going to be very helpful to us as a group as we sort through all of these comments. Right now, we're up to about 27 pages of comments and feedback from staff. And so by the time we're done with this, we're going to have quite a bit of information to go through, working with our HR partners and identifying those areas of priorities that we want to take a look at in moving forward. And as I said, I anticipate that we will, as an assembly, write a report back to the staff across the university to kind of let them know this is what we heard, this is where we're going, and how we expect to get there. But there could be more to follow on how that actually is communicated back to the staff community. So, So our guests are here. Are there any other brief announcements that anybody would like to make before our guests get started? One other point, our future guest on 12-5, Vice President Opperman, the topic is actually about core values statement that the university, the president has asked the assemblies to take a look at. So she and Reginald White will be discussing that with us. I believe 6.4 will either be a part of the larger discussion or a later date. So, all right.
And also, if anybody is interested in reviewing the data so far on the welfare committee, we've got Adam Howell, myself, maybe Andrea.
I did. I thought I responded.
With reviewing all of the feedback from the staff discussions to kind of suss out any sort of common themes, do a little bit of content coding. So if anybody is interested in helping out with that, that would be really good.
And all of it's accessible in Box. So please feel free to go in, take a look, start making some of your own notes. I think the more advanced work each one of us can do individually, reviewing those comments will lend to our productivity once we get to the mid-year retreat. So with that, I would ask, Mary Beth is here. And Mary Beth, can I ask if you would present first? Okay, great. So Mary Beth.
Right here.
Mary Beth Grant is the Senior Associate Dean of Students and is going to be talking to us about the Sorority and Fraternity Judicial Review Committee. So, thank you for being here.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I have not had the opportunity to participate with EA as much as some of the other assemblies, so I really appreciate seeing new faces and seeing some old faces and getting to be part of it. I feel like I'm a little soft. a mic?
No. Can the folks on Zoom hear? Okay.
I'll try to speak really loudly. Is that better?
Great.
Okay. So, as some of you may know, back in May, President Pollack issued a letter saying we need to clean up the Greek system. And she sent out a letter, May the 4th be with you, or something like that. And there were a number of different things that were mandated, some quick things that needed to be changed within the Office of Sorority and Fraternity Life. And then there were some other things that needed more review and a deeper dive and consideration. And the work that I've been overseeing since September is one of those deeper dive things. So the way that the context is that this is part of the charge from the president that then Brian Lombardi, as the vice president of SCL, has to look at it. The Office of Campus and Community Engagement is the office that houses Office of Sorority and Fraternity Life. This group, the Office of Campus and Community Engagement, is a sister organization to the Dean of Students Office. At one point, we were all together, and then we split up. And then there are 60 fraternities and sororities. Sometimes we'll use Greek system, and you'll see that the slides were inconsistent. The reason that I'm going to try not to always use Greek system, I'll probably use SFL more for sorority and fraternity life, is that some of these chapters, these houses, these groups, don't have houses, don't use Greek letters. So either chapters or SFL is what I'm going to try to use, and I apologize if I wind up being less inclusive by using a different term. This is the group, the committee that I've been chairing. It's a very mixed group, which has been really great. It's got faculty, students, and staff, which is typical at Cornell. It's got a mixture of people who are align with the Greek system, identify as having been in a sorority or a fraternity, and those of us who have not been. We have people who are alums on the committee because within the sorority and fraternity life system, alumni play a very important role with around education and financially and community spirit. There's a lot of reasons, a lot of traditions that the alums are very involved. So having them on the committee made sense. It's a group of 13, and Laura Santa Cruz is one of the people who's also on the committee. Is there anyone else here on the committee? No. We've got, as I said, a bunch of different people. This is the system that we're looking at. So this is the current system, and what we've been asked to do is a comprehensive look at just this part of the system, although our conversations do tend to stray into the other areas because, you know, it's all interrelated. Right now, if a complaint comes in, complaints about hazing, a complaint about a chapter being involved in a sexual assault, a complaint about party management issues where the party went on too long or they didn't have the proper permit, it would all come into the Office of Sorority and Fraternity Life. In the past, that director would do a triage. Currently, there's another group that's doing a triage together so that there's a couple more eyes on it. And there are three different ways that an issue could be resolved. The first way is an informal resolution. That would be a conversation between a member of the sorority fraternity life staff with an individual, or the chapter, rather. I keep saying individuals. I was the JA for years, and that's individual misbehavior. This process is around chapter group misbehavior, so if I split, that's why. Maybe there's something that is really a pretty low-level violation if it were true, so a conversation is enough. Or maybe it's something that was an anonymous report and we really can't tell whether or not anything happened, but you still want to have the opportunity to have an educational moment. Or maybe there's something that you just can't tell. They try to do an investigation. They just don't know one way or another, but they don't want to miss the opportunity to create an opportunity to learn, even if there's not a finding of violation. So those are the types of things that happen in the informal. Oh, and this is Christina Liang, who's also on the committee and serves as the Associate Judicial Administrator. Laura, I didn't say what work you do. You work in the Scorton Center. sorry. The other way that a case might be resolved. There's food for me.
Yeah, please help yourself.
The Greek Judicial Board is a group of students. They're all students who are within the Greek system. And they look at cases, allegations that are within the Greek rules, but don't necessarily rise to something like a hazing or the more serious types of misconduct that might be represented in the code or other places. So that might be that you don't have enough sober monitors at your party, or you didn't register your party, or there was a, you didn't close down the party soon enough, that you hung around too long, it was supposed to end at 2, and the Ubers didn't get there until 3, what's going on? So that's what the Greek Judicial Board does, and that's all students. There's an advisor, but it's a non-voting advisor. And then this is the board that we're looking at. So the way that the university has its relationship with the fraternity and sororities is that we have something called a recognition policy. And that's us saying, okay, private entity that's not Cornell controlled, you have the right to be part of our community, but you have to follow these rules. It's a contract, this recognition policy. So we're recognizing you as long as you follow these rules. So when there's an allegation that's so serious that they think that this recognition policy has been contravened, then that there would be a group that would look at that. So hazing, we definitely fit in there. If there is a sexual assault, that's not just that the individual acted badly, but there was something about the environment that created a predatory possibility, or worse, where they were actively all engaging in predatory behavior. Bias activities could fit in that. There's a number of different things that might lead to a chapter losing its recognition, where the university says, we no longer recognize you. There are other things they could do that are less serious than that, but that's the most serious thing. So we've been looking at this, and as we were looking at it, we wanted to first agree, or I thought it was important for us to first agree on what our core values are to make sure that we're all on the same page. And as you saw from the committee, such divergent backgrounds, but really the core values are the same among all of us. The first and foremost is that we want to make sure the community is safe, both the people within the chapters as well as the broader community. Fundamental fairness has to be part of any conduct system. So we have to make sure that people are getting noticed, they're having the opportunity to be heard, that they're having the opportunity to receive support that they need, in the criminal justice world, people might use the expression due process. People are more familiar with that. But in a higher ed world, we use the expression of fundamental fairness. So to give you a sense of when somebody is being called before a board and being asked to be accountable, are they being given a fair shake to say, yes, I did it, and help me figure out how I can learn and grow? Or no, that's not exactly right. This is what I really think happened. So that's the fundamental fairness. Transparency is essential. Cornell is actually a leader in this area. We've had a Cornell, hazing.com?
Hazing.cornell.edu.
Oh, hazing.cornell.edu website for over 10 years,
yeah,
right?
2005.
2005, wow, 13 years. That has on it different types of hazing allegations and the results of it. So we've had that for a really long time. In President Pollack's letter from May, she's asked for even more transparency. So we're talking about that in our committee. To be honest, it's already covered, but we're just emphasizing that this is something that we really support and believe in and know has to happen. And then the other part about it is that it has to be an educational system in the higher ed context. So a minute ago, I referred to a criminal justice process and used some constitutional language because we're used to hearing that kind of language. But as we're developing a system or examining a system, we shouldn't be comparing us to a criminal justice system. We should really be thinking about what does a system of accountability look like in higher ed, and that's something that we keep coming back to. And we have discovered that the current system falls short in a couple of significant ways. For one thing, the system is complex. Having those three different areas with different processes for each of them can be a challenge for people to understand, for the students to understand. There are some ways that, unfortunately, the system has not demonstrated fundamental fairness. It has been described to the board that there's been some inequities about who has information during a hearing process. So there might be somebody who participated in the investigation, and there was an anonymous or a confidential witness, and that person is sitting there on the board and knows the information, and the chapter doesn't know the information. Everybody should know the same information in order to be able to deal with it. Sometimes the investigators are sitting on the board that's making the decision, and that's not a typical practice, so that's something that we are concerned about. Also, the board itself is somewhat ad hoc. Rather than having a set pool of people who are called over and over, who have had training and who have an expertise, it could be a little bit more ad hoc, where this time we have five people who are available, this time we have seven or eight. So we really want to make sure that there's a standard practice and that we always have trained people. The triaging has been imperfect, although I'm learning that that's been taken care of a little bit. But in the past, some cases were referred to the Greek Judicial Board, the student-run group that's really supposed to do event management stuff. Some cases that were more serious were referred there in error. So we want to make sure that we make recommendations around the triaging. But you know, the biggest thing is that there is just a lack of confidence right now. And what surprised me most is how much the lack of confidence was really community-wide. People who were within the Greek system didn't trust the system because they think that non-Greeks are out to get them, trying to close down their houses. And people outside of the Greek system think that the processes are set up as a way for them to protect themselves and be very insular. So, I don't know, I guess you can really feel that a system has some work to do when nobody trusts it, whether inside or out. So these are the short-term meaningful changes that we are going to be recommending to take place by February, so that the next semester in January is when the recruiting process starts for many chapters. So we unfortunately find some referrals during that time period. So we really want to be in place, ready to go for next semester. So these will be the short-term changes. You'll notice that we're not using the word tweak. We started using the word tweak, but it's actually not. They're meaningful changes. We hope that they're not going to be super hard to implement, but they will have some real value in adding to the fairness of the process. So first of all, we're rewriting the procedures to make sure that they're very clear and understandable and have the appropriate amount of detail. We're going to be recruiting and training. I use we as the royal we. I don't think that the three of us will be doing that, but somebody will. Recruit and train review board panel members so that there's some consistency in that board and that there are people who are trained appropriately. The investigators will not be serving on the decision-making panel, and the full investigative report will be given to everybody who's involved in the hearing so that there won't be some people in the room who have more information than others. And then the last point is just around the transparency again. That's already happening, but we'll go ahead and include it in our short-term goals. And this is where I really wanted to get the input from you all. These are some of the things that we're looking at for long-term revisions. There's a couple of ideas on the table right now for structural things, and we're processing them a little bit more. One idea is to use a system similar to the policy 6.4 for sexual assaults, where there's a single investigator model. There's another idea that's come out that's called a branch approach that I don't really understand yet. So we're not really in a position to share those with you yet. But these are some smaller questions that we've been trying to sort through and really wanted to get some more input from the community as we're in that decision-making process. So the first one is that many of us think that we shouldn't put our colleagues in SFL, in the office of SFL, in the position where they have to both be the strongest advocate for the Greek system on campus, but also be in the position where they have to oversee the conduct work. So we think that it would make sense to remove the conduct work to a different office. And there are some ramifications about that, you know, both from a staffing perspective, and people have different ideas about how it may or may not be beneficial. But if anybody has thoughts about that, we've been talking about the membership of the board. Should there be more non-Greek people on the board? Should there be more Greek people on the board? We've heard things on different perspectives on that. Should there be students on the board? This relationship between the university and the chapters is really a fiduciary relationship with the Board of Trustees. And so some people are saying we shouldn't be having students on those boards making those kinds of decisions. And other people say, well, no, that's part of shared governance. So if you all have opinions about that, faculty members, it turns out, are also controversial. And I don't particularly know why, because faculty members are on many boards, but if you have an opinion about whether faculty members should be on the board. Aside from who's on the board, there's also the roles of the parties in the hearing. So should harmed parties be allowed to be part of the hearing, give a harmed statement? Sometimes people don't want to be known. They have experienced hazing by people that they consider brothers or sisters. But for some people, they might want to talk about that, and should they be given that opportunity? What should the role of the alumni or alumnae be? You know, maybe there's a more of a commitment by that those groups to have a longer-term relationship both with the chapter and the institution, independent of the students, and then maybe there's a different role that they should have. Certainly the alumni believe that. I think the rest of the committee is not quite convinced, but I'd be curious to hear your thoughts around that. If OSFL is no longer going to be overseeing conduct, what other roles should they have? Should they be the experts? Should they be an advisor? Should they be a support person? What roles could we see as being an educational role for them? And then if a chapter has an advisor, currently the practice is that, and this is a standard practice in conduct around the nation, the students have to speak directly to the board, and the advisor is there as a support person and can help the students beforehand prepare, have a private conversation in the hall or whisper in their ear to help encourage them. But other people feel they should serve as more of an advocate, which is not the norm across the nation. But I'd be curious to hear if any of you have opinions about that. And then the last thing we're trying to assess is if there's an appropriate use of alternative dispute resolution, like mediation or restorative justice. Some people say, well, that would be fine as long as it's not a super serious case. Other people say, well, it's really addressing something different because we really want to find out about how to heal the harm that's caused and not just be punitive or worry about the education of the people who engaged in bad behavior. So I, at this point, would just open up the floor to any thoughts that you all have. And I didn't bring any paper. Okay, great. Any either questions or thoughts about what we should think about for the going forward or ideas about any of these?
I have a quick question. I was on the university assembly last year.
Uh-huh.
So the question I have for you is for these boards that you have, and if, you know, someone puts in a complaint, at what part do they, if they see that the complaint violates the code, does that go, where does that go?
Christina, do you want to speak to that?
Sure.
Sorry, I'm standing on the opposite end of the room. So currently, it really depends on the allegation, because right now if there is a hazing allegation, there is a hazing reporting incident report form that's on the Office of Sorority and Fraternity and Life website that can be reported, and then there's a group of people, including our office, who would respond to that. And so if there is a very clear code of conduct violation that our office has jurisdiction over, meaning non-Greek student organizations, then it would fall under our office and we would continue with the code process. Generally speaking, I think if people have concerns about a code violation, we always encourage people to report it and leave it to our office to decide whether or not we have jurisdiction. Does that answer your question?
And just to add,
theoretically, it's supposed to be reported to the review board. And as MB was pointing out, that there have been some mistakes where those code violations have been incorrectly gone to the judicial review group.
Yes,
but,
the Greek
judicial
yeah.
board. Incorrect.
Yes.
I'm curious about safety, you know, out of curiosity, because most of the time you hear on the news after hazing already happened and somebody is already dead. So how do you ensure safety, you know, in a Greek house with, you know, around, there could be alcohol, there could be a lot of things, you know, and you don't send the police there.
Yeah.
And, you know, what happens, and we hear about it later.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point, and the work that this committee is doing is a very small slice of pie compared to the whole big holistic work that campus colleagues are doing to try to create healthier environments, both within the Greek system and outside of the Greek system. Do you want to talk about some of the initiatives that the Skorton Center
does? Yeah, sure. So, it's a really important thing that you're bringing up, that oftentimes with hazing, what we see in the news are really kind of the tip of the iceberg, the really horrific, brutal alcohol poisoning cases, physical brutality, and often cases that have led to death. And then underneath, you know, if you think about an iceberg, there's a whole lot of other forms of hazing that are often going on that are not as visible and not going to be reported in the news as often. And so I think just in terms of what can these groups do, when there is a report made to the university, there are processes in which we can put chapters or organizations on interim suspension, asking them to cease all activities. If we learn about some form of hazing behavior that we're really concerned about and we want to prevent further harm or prevent it from happening. So sometimes we might catch wind and staff, students, faculty, anybody can make these reports to the university on the hazing.cornell.edu website. And if we learn about something that's planned for a few days later, well, we can absolutely do something about preventing that. If we hear about it after the fact, we can look into that and investigate what took place, and we can also consider interim suspension measures or interim practices to try to prevent further harm from happening. So that's one specific piece. And then the other piece is, I'll be talking later to this group about Intervene as one example of our bystander intervention programs where we're trying to help bring about awareness about what hazing actually is. Because when you say to students or to people in general, have you ever been hazed? They will say no, right? They won't, but if you ask them specific behaviors, have you ever had to, you know, consume excessive amounts of XYZ, you know, object or liquid or food item? Or have you ever been, you know, forced to come to a house at 2 a.m. and asked to line up and be asked a bunch of questions about the history of your organization? And if you get those answers wrong, you're then forced to do calisthenics. And they'll say, yeah, I've had to do those things. So they've experienced the hazing behaviors, but they won't label their experience as hazing. And so there's a lot of educational work that needs to happen to help people connect the dots. Then that's part of the work that we're doing with Intervene and other trainings as well.
Laura and Mary Beth, with regard to further follow-up action or comments, would it be easiest if other members have items that they think about later on just to email you? Or
yeah, that would be awesome. Meg36 is my net ID, and I would welcome any ideas that you all have, and we'll bring them back to the committee for further discussion.
Christine, I saw your hands up. Oh, I was just going to add, I'm sorry, over your name, to the question you had asked, that a lot of what Laura's office is doing is very proactive, and that's awesome, because we do want to address an issue before it becomes a problem. A lot of the work that the JA's office does is a little bit more reactive, right? Something has occurred, and I think the other component of the safety protection is to hold people accountable, right? In both an educational way, but also in the sense of, okay, well, what's happened here was so egregious that we really need to take a time out and address, okay, while the recognition is removed, what steps are you going to take so that when you are welcomed back as a recognized group, that this won't happen again? And so I think it's attacking the issue at two different ways, in a proactive approach, but also reacting in a way that's proportionate and ultimately protecting the safety of our community. So I want to add that.
Yes, Anne.
I'm going to take this sort of conversation
country where there is no Greek life and there's no, never heard of hazing until I got here. Mm-hmm. And so could you just help me understand what is the culture or the psychological sort of like environment that produces this hazing, and why is it so continuous even though people know, everybody seems to know that it's you know, it's an undesirable, it's not, what is the advantage of, why do they do it? Anybody tell me why?
I'll let you do it.
Yeah,
I might be thinking inappropriately.
What you're asking is an incredibly important question that is very hard to answer. The field of hazing, like if you look at the evidence-based literature, it's like this big. There is very little actually studying it. There are some anthropologists who have looked at, you know, our need as humans to belong to groups and the different ways in which organizational behavior theories say that we need to create commitment and group solidarity and cohesion to be able to have a functioning group. There are some psychologists who have looked at kind of the what happens when you have, you know, sadists and masochist people who like inflicting pain on other people, and when you have a large population, there's a chance that there will be some of those people in the mix, and what are their tendencies in terms of creating activities to welcome people. And there's some interesting literature about, you know, oftentimes students will justify and say that they need to produce the bonds, that you are joining. And these Greek sororities and fraternities happen to have lifelong membership. That's different than a lot of other student organizations on campus, right? Many registered student organizations, you can belong as a member as an undergraduate or graduate or professional student, and then when you graduate, you're no longer a member of that club. But with these sororities and fraternities, there actually is lifelong membership, and that creates some interesting challenges. And so with that, people tend to want to create this group solidarity, this need to have some sort of cohesion among the group, and they just repeat the practices that have been done to them over and over and over. Some of these organizations have been around for over 100 years in this country. And there's this kind of psychological process that people might go through after they've been through it to justify, to make it make sense to themselves, to feel kind of okay about the practices that were done to them because they gained something in return. So there's kind of this complex psychological component to it. When you say that everybody agrees it's a problem, not among students. So there are many students who will justify and who will defend and say, I liked what happened to me, I enjoyed the challenge, and I can't wait to do it to the next round of people. That's what we're up against.
And some alums feel that way.
And alums feel very strongly.
That was my follow-up question. I mean, like, can that be the explanation of why the literature is so thin? It's because that there are powerful people who remain in these organizations who could possibly suppress, you know, and, you know, land up on trustees, trustee boards, and have, you know, sort of like overdue influence over what actually does and doesn't happen to manage these topics.
And there are, again, I don't work in the Office of Sorority and Fraternity Life, but there have been, over the years, there have been many changes that have been making incremental progress in the right direction related to shortening new member periods, for instance. So for many years, organizations could have, you know, 2 months, 3 months long orientation, pledging processes. That's insane. You don't need that, right, to be able to join an organization. And so they were able to cut that down to 4 weeks. The other complicating factor with Greek sorority fraternity organizations is that they have these national headquarters, national organizations that also stipulate what they believe are traditions, which by our definition are hazing and violate our code of conduct policy. But the national organization is telling the local Cornell affiliate of that chapter to do this behavior. And so they're stuck in the middle saying, well, Cornell's telling me not to do this, and my national's telling me to do this, and my alumni's telling me, well, I did, and I was fine. And the person who's only a year older than me, but is the new member educator, is telling me I have to go through with this. And then you can see the complex reasons that people go along with these activities. They may explicitly consent to it, but they can't really because of the pressures and the power differentials and the hierarchy that exists within all of these structures. But they have made some changes, and in addition to shortening the period, they also do require that all new member educators
of these organizations put forth their new member education plans to the office and that the office reviews them. The challenge, of course, is that what are the students writing isn't necessarily what they're doing. And then, as someone earlier said, you know, do you just send the police to check on that? I mean, it's very hard to figure out ways to actually do the enforcement piece that Christina talked about as being so critical to the cycle of preventing hazing. And to add another layer of complexity, many of these organizations that do have houses, some of them are owned by the university, so therefore we have jurisdiction, and therefore Cornell University Police have jurisdiction. Some of these houses are privately owned. And so Cornell doesn't have jurisdiction, and so it creates another layer. So then we have to ask our Ithaca Police Department colleagues, might you be willing, in all of your priorities that you have to keep the community of Ithaca safe, could you go check on this fraternity house? So it becomes, and not to say that this is it's impossible to do anything, because there are lots of things that we can and need to be doing. And also, I would encourage you, if anyone's really interested, one, I'd be happy to talk further about hazing, but two, if you go on to our hazing.cornell.edu webpage, in addition to the reporting mechanism that anybody, student, staff, alumni, parents, family members, anybody can make a report to the university, there's also a document on there that we've developed that's our hazing framework. And it talks about a comprehensive public health approach to addressing, preventing, responding to, and holding organizations and individuals accountable for hazing. So I'd encourage you to look at that as well.
Last question before we move to the next topic.
It's not a question, but you might want to plug your ears on this one.
Uh-oh.
No. I mean, hazing is just geared towards fraternities and sororities. It's commonplace. It's kind of like military in the Navy. It was rite of passage. You know, we cross the equator, come a shell back, you get hazed.
Yeah.
You go up to the Arctic Circle where I did, you cross that line, it's hazing. But it was just a common thing. And really what it was rite of passage.
Right.
You go from a petty officer to a chief officer, and they'll tack that on you, and you get hazed. But it was just common, you know, back then. But really, that's all it was rite of passage.
Right. And I think it's really important point that hazing occurs in any type of group, organization, club, team, not just Greek letters, sorority, fraternities, military for sure, a cappella, performing arts organizations, athletic teams, pre-professional organizations. It's a phenomenon that is found in lots of different groups, teams, organizations, clubs. And it is often talked about as in terms of a rite of passage, that you're marking kind of the transition from being a new member to an existing, you know, a full member or a new position, for example. But like many problems in our society that have once been considered commonplace, this is now becoming understood as actually a real public health concern and a form of interpersonal violence that is detrimental to one's mental health, often involves alcohol and alcohol poisoning. We've seen multiple deaths. There were 4 young men last year who actually were very publicly talked about as being killed by alcohol poisoning as a result of their hazing experiences. And often also involves sexual violence in the forms of hazing. And so it really is becoming a bigger issue. It's not necessarily the prevalence so much, but that it's being understood and seen for the problems that are facing people a long time after they've experienced that rite of passage. And what we try to do is work with organizations to help them come up with rites of passage that aren't dehumanizing, degrading, humiliating, intimidating, hurtful, harmful, physically or otherwise. Because we're not saying tradition's bad. There's lots of graduation at Cornell is a wonderful tradition, right? That's marked with some really interesting things. We have robes, we have the procession, we have a pattern, we have speak. There's lots of things that are traditional about that experience. So tradition isn't the problem, but it's the types of activities and the ways in which these activities go about that become really problematic hazing behaviors.
Thank you very much. Laura is also our next.
Yeah, okay. I'm
going to eat.
I did. Yeah,
And it wasn't almost to the point where I wanted to show him my cup.
My name is Laura Santa Cruz, and I'm the Assistant Director for the Sporton Center for Health Initiatives, which is a department within Cornell Health. So oftentimes I think when people think of Cornell Health, they think of clinicians, they think of doctors and psychologists, and we have all of those people in Cornell Health. I am not one of those people. So my background is in public health. I actually went to Cornell myself as an undergrad, and then I've been back working for almost 4.5 years, I guess, now. And so within the Sporton Center for Health Initiatives, we are essentially the public health kind of outreach arm of Cornell Health. So the population that we treat rather than individuals like you think of a doctor, our population of interest, our patient, is the Cornell student population. So here we go. So we use a public health approach to address kind of four key topic areas of concern among college students. So alcohol and other drugs, mental health, sexual violence, and hazing, which we've been talking about a lot, which is great. To talk about it. The way in which that we work, so we were formerly known as Health Promotion, the Department of Health Promotion within Gannett Health Services. And when former President David Sporton left the university, the Board of Trustees wanted to honor him and his commitment to health and well-being. As you may know, he was a physician by training and really committed to the public health, population health at Cornell. And so that's why we were kind of renamed, rebranded, and given a slightly different mission. And so we work to address these topic areas in a couple of ways, by providing institutional leadership. We do that by coordinating coalitions on particular topics where we bring together important stakeholders, students, staff, faculty, alumni, community partners where appropriate, to talk about these issues. We also do a lot of education, both in terms of delivering health education programming and training to the student community, student employees, to academic classes, guest lectures, et cetera. And also we actually educate students in internships and in a public health fellowship position where we train future public health practitioners to work in college campuses. And then we conduct a lot of research. So we're trying to actually increase the gap in the hazing literature. We're working on a manuscript right now actually about the prevalence of hazing at Cornell. Because it's, like I said, there's a dearth of information. And so we do a lot of surveys to learn about prevalence and behaviors on campus, and then use that to inform policies, programs, strategic decisions about what we need to be doing, campaign materials, et cetera. And then public engagement as well, meaning that there is not a whole lot of college health professionals who use a public health approach. It's kind of a new thing. And so, and also not all health promotion or public health, college health departments are as well resourced as we are at Cornell. We're very fortunate that we have support from Cornell. We have support from Cornell alumni who often help to fund our initiatives. And so we try to share our materials, our programs, our research in a very transparent way with other campuses across the country where we can help out. And then what do? We develop, we implement, we evaluate evidence-based and theory-informed strategies, like I mentioned, using the socio-ecological model, which you may be familiar with, but this idea that we as individuals don't just operate in a bubble. If we did, we'd be very safe and healthy all the time because you would just be on your own will to do that. But that individual behavior is influenced by multiple levels, right, of interaction, of the group interaction, interpersonal connections, groups that you belong to, the institution that you belong to, the larger community and society that we belong to. So we work to develop interventions at multiple layers of that socio-ecological model. So I was asked to speak a little bit about Intervene, I think, in response to the Daily Sun article that many of you probably read about a very public incident that happened on North Campus where we actually had two real strong heroes who stepped in and intervened to try to help prevent further harm and get help for the individual who was in need of help.
So Intervene was created a while ago, which I'll talk about how we developed it. But this is one of the bystander intervention programs that exists on this campus that we train undergraduate, graduate, and professional students in. So Intervene is a standalone online 20-minute video that I hope many of you got to watch in advance of this meeting. People are nodding, that's great. And so you saw students are portraying how to successfully intervene in 7 distinct situations over time. And then in addition to the video, we made a corresponding 60-minute workshop that students get to view the video and then have a facilitated conversation to go in depth about what they're learning about, the attitudes and the skills that they need to apply, and also campus resources that can be helpful. What's important was that the video and the workshop were based on real-life situations that undergraduate, graduate, and professional students here at Cornell have faced. And so we did that by doing focus groups with students. We also looked at all of the survey data that was available to us on this campus about these topics to really inform not only the topics that were included, but the actual scenarios and the ways in which people can intervene. And then lastly, it's grounded in social behavioral theories, including Albert Bandura's social cognitive theory, that we learn by model, like a person can model behavior and then we can learn that behavior, as well as the pro-social bystander model itself. So there's some unique features about it. One of the things is that we really felt strongly about making it be an empowering and realistic approach to problem solving. That's really important because a lot of the programs on the market are really fear-based. So you'll see, like, if you don't do this, you will die. And that doesn't work for adolescents, right? Young adults have this idea of invincibility, and so that's a mismatch in terms of strategy and actuality. So we wanted to make it empowering. We also wanted to show that these skills can actually apply to multiple topics. So a lot of the products on the market are focused exclusively on, like, sexual violence. And while that is important and needed, it's not like we're asking you to learn how to intervene just in this topic, because the skills you could apply, you can interrupt behaviors and use distraction techniques and say something and offer support in a variety of situations. And often colleges are asked to do that on a college campus. You're supposed to train everybody up and you're given 20 minutes to do it and talk about alcohol and sexual violence and hazing and bias and, right, and the list goes on and on, which is hard. What we wanted to show is how you could intervene if you're an individual, but also if you're a part of a group, if you have more people around you, what that could look like. Model those different options. Depict a range of severity. So oftentimes people think about, you know, if you see something, say something. That's like the way that we've conceptualized bystander behavior in our country of recent. And that's important. And most people are like, yeah, I know what to do in an emergency situation. I call 911, but I don't know what to do in an urgent or in a non-urgent, but I'm still concerned, right? So wanting to show that the ways in which these skills can be applied to multiple situations. And then also we want to talk and show the role of bystanders in a situation as they develop over time, that not always is it gonna be so neat and done and pretty that all I have to do is call 911 and then get to walk away. But sometimes you might notice a pattern of problematic behavior for a while and how you can intervene in that type of situation. We also wanted to address the multiple kinds of relationships that exist on a college campus and how your strategies and skill set might look different. So for, you know, friends intervening on behalf of a friend, strangers, acquaintances, classmates, roommates, we tried to show variety of relationships in the film as well. And of course, it was designed for college students, but what we mean by that was it was designed for undergrads, grads, and professionals. Bless you. And that was really important because, again, a lot of the programs are focused exclusively on undergrads. And grad and professionals make up a large part of our campus and of other college campuses and deal with these same issues in slightly different ways. So that was important as well. And then thankfully, thanks to the United Educators, the insuring agency that insures Cornell, as well as generous alumni donations, we were able to do a rigorous evaluation and we did a randomized control trial of the video, and I'll show you the results in a little bit. But the short answer is it's effective, which is really great. So you can see here, it took us a while to develop this. It took us about a year. We started back in spring of 2016, and we were using a video that American University had developed that was about 5.5 minutes long. That was good, but had that fear-based kind of tactic, was very much branded as American University. And interestingly, when we piloted here at Cornell, students were very quick to say they hated that the characters broke the fourth wall, that they would talk right through, they'd be acting, and then they talk right through the TV screen and say, here at American University, we step up, you know? They hated that. So we learned that really quickly, that they didn't like the suspension, you know, they wanted to just live as its own thing.
So we learned a lot, and we did these focus groups to learn a lot more, and all that information informed our script writing process. We worked and hired the Cornell Interactive Theater Ensemble to help us, because we were the experts in the topics and the research and the survey work, but I've never written a movie before, so we worked with people who were experts in writing and scripting and acting and directing. Then we actually vetted that script with over 100 people, students, staff experts, faculty, communications experts, all the way up the totem pole at Cornell, and made modifications but kept the realness of the language of the film. Then we, in the spring of 2016, we hired a cast of about 100 people to be in the movie, and then scattered locations. You might have noticed some places on campus that we used to film it, and it took us a week, actually, to film the whole process. And then that summer, we ended the video with the help of Photosynthesis, who is our production company as well. And then that summer, we were developing the workshop and putting the final touches on our RCT, which we then conducted in the fall of 2016, and then led us to eventually finally launching it for everybody at Cornell in spring of 2017, as well as across the country. So we presented it at a national conference and shared the resources for free to other universities as well. Okay. And so we're really happy to share that we've gotten really great feedback and received some awards about for Intervene. So NASPA, the Student Affairs Administration in Higher Education, that organization awarded us the Bronze Student Health Wellness Template and Related Excellence Award. And similarly, the American College Health Association awarded us the Best Practice Award in Health Promotion and Education for Intervene. My personal favorite is, as a public health person, the American Public Health Association has a Global and Public Health Film Festival, and Intervene was accepted to be screened at the conference there and shared. And then this is really fun. The production company, Photosynthesis, submitted Intervene to be considered for a Telly Award. And the Silver Telly Award is actually the highest Telly Award that is given. They don't have a gold. It's just kind of interesting. But it's for short videos, commercials, et cetera. And so we actually won the 2017 Silver Telly Award for Intervene, and you can't really make it out. But in the category that we were awarded, which is non-broadcast social responsibility, there's actually a commercial that Coca-Cola made called Walk in My Shoes. That was a really popular Coca-Cola commercial. That's in the same category that we won with Intervene. So I think that's pretty cool that they thought that the quality of the film itself was of high quality. So that's all thanks to Photosynthesis. So these are the seven different topics that are explored in the film that you watched: emotional distress, teasing, intimate partner violence, focusing on the emotional control and manipulation aspect rather than physical abuse, racial bias and alcohol emergency, sexual harassment, as well as the potential sexual assault. And so we wanted to evaluate it. So we really wanted to know, does watching the standalone video have an impact on people's self-reported likelihood to intervene, right? If you just watch a 20-minute video, does it do anything for people? And so we set out to look at this, and what we were really happy with that, we measured like a pre and a post, right, as like a manipulation check, but before watching the film and immediately after watching the film, were you more likely to intervene? And thankfully, across the board, all seven situations immediately after viewing, people said that they were statistically significantly more likely to intervene in all seven scenarios. But more importantly, 4 weeks after, so a month after they watched the film, they were surveyed again, and we found in the video condition that they were statistically significantly more likely to intervene for 4 out of the 7 scenarios compared to their control group counterparts. So we saw this effect for the pain scene, the racial bias scene, the IPV scene, and the sexual harassment scene. So that's really great, the 4 out of the 7. And then for the 3 scenes that were not significant at 4 weeks, alcohol, sexual assault, and emotional distress, we had some hypotheses. The alcohol scene and the sexual assault scene, it was really a ceiling effect. Like, they were already really high and really likely to intervene in those situations before the film, so there wasn't really much room for them to grow. And we think that's in part a reflection of the work that Cornell has already done with requiring all incoming undergraduate students to complete an alcohol online training before they arrive on campus, the Good Samaritan protocol that we have on campus, et cetera. And then similarly with sexual assault, they're all required to participate in the Speak About It training for undergrads. Graduate students are required to complete an online training as well. So there's already a lot of messages about you should do something if someone is passed out from alcohol and being sexually assaulted. So with the emotional distress scene, it was a little bit different. That was more of a floor effect because in the scene, as you watched it, it's a bit of a harder ask. We're asking
stranger or kind of an acquaintance to offer help to someone who seems to be in emotional distress. And that's scary, right? It's a bit easier to ask people to check in on their friend when they're crying or when they're upset. But to do that for a stranger is a bit harder. But we really wanted to model that in this film, building on our programming that we'd already developed around our notice and response suite of programs. We have our notice and response friend to friend for undergrads, and notice and response assisting students in distress for staff and faculty and graduate TAs. So that was really important as well. But what was great was that the video was equally effective for undergrads and graduate professional students. So that was really wonderful. We set out to make something that would work for everybody, and it did. And then just to share a couple of examples of who and how we've used the training, all Berkeley athletes every year have something called the Athlete Extravaganza, where they put like all 1,200 of them in Bailey Hall. And so we've been able to show the video for the past 2 years in a row. So they've been able to watch the video. As well as this year, there's a new training as part of Martha Pollack's May 4th letter to the Greek community, requiring all students who are prospective new members, who are considering joining a sorority or fraternity in the spring, are required to go through training this fall, and we're providing part of that training and using Intervene as a part of it. So they're all getting to see the video as well. And then we've also embedded it in some required online trainings that student leaders have to watch online. And then the workshops that we've done this with a bunch of different student staff. The students who work the Big Red Shuttle, who drive around late at night, they've been trained, and we know of a few of them who have actually been able to do some really wonderful interventions where they've seen people driving by who looked like they were in trouble and were able to either call or get them on the bus, et cetera. RAs, West Campus student staff who work in the residential community, co-op leaders, ROTC students as well. Some service fraternities and social fraternities and athletic teams as well have done the training itself of the hour-long program. And then with grad and professional students, the Graduate Women in Science groups asked us to do a training for them, and we had a wonderful training for about 100 students. The West Campus folks had mentioned the College of Veterinary Medicine has a peer mentor program that we've done. We've used the emotional distress team in particular for a larger program. Jenna LeMay and the graduate school have created this graduate perspective sessions, and we've done Intervene with a focus on the sexual violence topics as part of Sexual Assault Awareness Week the past couple of years. And then there's also a graduate professional student mental health committee that we've also done the training with. And just some qualitative feedback from the grad student community, which I think is important. You know, the person was like, the video is so well done. It's like, okay, great. Photosynthesis. But the next comment I think was really interesting, that they wrote, I think Intervene was a great resource to spark discussion and conversation in some difficult topics, even when someone's response is, that's not realistic because. We still learn from a different perspective. I also think it was useful to know about the Good Samaritan Law in New York State. It's a good incentive to take action in a given situation. And overall, great to have discussed and heard others' opinions, and I love learning about the campus resources slide. So you can see that even when they felt like the video may not have been directly relevant or everything wasn't exactly realistic, they still were able to get something out of it, which was the goal. And I mentioned that we've been sharing the video and the workshop for free with other universities. And to my knowledge, over 30 other campuses have actually already been using it since spring of 2017. I keep learning about new campuses who end up writing to me asking about our evaluation or something, but we're really excited and you can see it's kind of across the board, but Princeton is the only other Ivy that I'm aware of that has been using it. I haven't added, but I believe Stanford is using it as well now, which is one of our Ivy Plus peers. But lots of people are using it, which is really exciting. And then if you want to access any more information, the webpage is help.cornell.edu/intervene. And up there, you'll find there's different video platforms that all have captions. So the video lives on Vimeo, YouTube, and Cornellcast, all the places it can. And if you're looking for the individual scene links, the Cornell Cast page allows you to do that, which is nice. We have this one pager that kind of describes a little bit about what I've been sharing with you all, as well as a PowerPoint slide deck that's the facilitated discussion guide. So we designed the hour-long workshop so that I'm happy to come and do the training for organizations, but other people can also do the training. And we're happy to consult and talk with people, but all of those materials are online, and the script for the facilitators and the notes of the PowerPoint itself. And then, if anybody is interested in requesting an Intervene training for any students that you work with, you can always contact me, LBS65 or 65 pounds, my med ID. And then the other thing I mentioned was the
the bystander-driven programs, we also have focused on students in distress around emotional distress or potential suicidal thoughts. And so if you're at all interested in requesting the Notice and Respond program, either friend of friend or the one for staff and faculty, you can contact my colleague Catherine, and her net ID is CT265. Thank you very much for your time and your attention.
Laura, thank you. And are other questions for Laura about the intervening program? Or?
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
I watched the video. A lot of the skits were really, I think, very relevant for a lot of students and really great for student advocacy. So here at the Employee Assembly, what are some suggestions that you have for our unique, you know, group in terms of how we can help with intervention, with advocacy, with any of that?
Absolutely. So great question. Thank you. I think that one is that if there are student groups that you work with, in your department, in your, you know, student employees, anything like that, we'd be happy to coordinate trainings for them with your help, of course. I think the other thing is that it can be really helpful for staff to learn about the student experience. So we're always happy to come and talk about, these are very real situations that happen every day to students here at Cornell. And sometimes it's really important to recognize that if a student's not showing up to their job, or they're coming to you in a fragile state, or, you know, they're acting in a way, for you to think through, like, what might actually be going on for the student, and to be able to connect with them in that way. So I'm happy to have conversations with staff about that in terms of how they work with students. And then in terms of staff themselves, I think that the topics are actually still very applicable. And oftentimes when I've done this for staff departments, we've had conversations about, how do I intervene when I'm concerned a colleague might have a drinking problem? Or what might I do if I'm concerned that my colleague is in an abusive relationship or an unhealthy relationship? Or, so there's lots of ways that these topics actually are applicable to staff lives. We just haven't made that video because our domain is, of course, is helping students. But I know that there are folks within Human Resources who also have their own kind of corresponding trainings and programs related to those topics, but I'd be happy to talk with anybody about ways to respond and resources that are available to help staff themselves deal with these issues with other staff. And I'll put out a plug too that within Cornell Health, the Faculty and Staff Assistance Program is a really, really important and wonderful resource that is free, people don't know about it, in College Town that allows for employees to be able to talk confidentially with a counselor about any issue that might be going on. That's really important.
And for your awareness, I was invited to join Vice President Lombardi and in the recognition of Roger Gordon for his actions on that that day. So he was publicly acknowledged by the university, and so it was a really brave action that he took in that case. So thank you very much, Laura, Mary Beth.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Yeah. Appreciate it. We have one final guest for this afternoon. I'd like to introduce Dustin Cutler, who's the director of dining. So please, floor
thanks,
is yours.
Sir. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to invite Chef Dulo up with me.
All right. Absolutely.
All right. We come bearing gifts.
Mary Beth, how are you?
Good to see you.
With my
good too.
I'm going to take one of these. Have everyone grab one of each, okay? Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Dustin Cutler. I am the Director of Dining here at Cornell University. I've been here for roughly a little over a year and a half, actually going on 2 years now. And I want to say thank you so much for the opportunity to get in front of all of you today. I'm here to talk about a program that Cornell Dining has partnered with Cornell Human Resources. And it's a product launch that Chef Dulo worked on. And the thought process behind this was to provide convenient, hearty meals for people that don't have enough time to go home and make a meal for their families because they're so busy with work and other things that are outside of work as well. So we came up with a program. It's called Take Us Home. Essentially, it's a home meal replacement. And I won't dive into the food portion too much. I'll let you talk about that, Chef. But we went on this journey for about 4 months to figure out how we can provide fresh prepared food made every single day, cooked, put in a blast chiller, and then dropped off at retail locations so that they are convenient for people to pick these items up. The great thing is the price point ranges from $7.99 to $9.99. We've launched four items, which you'll see in this card that we're passing along. You will be receiving a pamphlet kind of explaining the program, as well as some insight, and a free meal as well, which is great. So on Cornell Dining, we also handed these out at the President Excellence Awards to about 200 people. We've received really positive feedback. The food tastes very fresh, and it's very tasty as well. Chef worked some time on it. You can find these home meal replacements at Bare Necessities and Robert Purcell. We strategically tried to place them around campus so that we could be spread out as much as possible without, you know, offering them everywhere if you want to see how this line is actually going to work. So you can find them at Bare Necessities at Robert Purcell, Matin's Cafe in Duffield, Cafe Jenny at the Cornell Store, AB Cafe in Olin Library, Trillium in Kennedy Hall, Jansen's Market in Noyes, and then Green Dragon is an area that we just recently entered into, and that's at Sibley Hall. So try a free meal on us. I hope that everybody really enjoys and received really positive feedback. I've heard some things like, you know, for Justin, for us to get which I hate to hear, people going to McDonald's and picking up a meal for their kids and their family, that's running about $7 a meal. So we really try to keep this at almost a break-even standpoint for my organization to provide healthy meals to the Cornell community. So I encourage you to please give them a try, a free meal on us, and I'd love to hear your feedback. So with that, I'd like to just hand it over to Chef Zulu and talk a little bit about what the process was like. Some people may think that these four meals, you just whip them up and then, you know, they're figured out in a couple of weeks. This actually took several months to figuring out packaging, logistics, staffing ratios, how we fit this into our infrastructure, how we still make them tasty and all those lines. So, Chef, at that point, I'll hand it over to you. And just a final thanks from me for the opportunity to get in front of all of you today.
Thank you, Dustin.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dustin, and thank you, Craig, for having us today that we can talk about this. And good afternoon to everyone. I'll keep this short because I think this is the end of your day. As Dustin said, we did spend several months working on this project. We came up with a list about this long. So we could filter out what type of items most people would be enthralled with, hopefully. And we ended up developing about 8 different products over the summer in conjunction with the 3 Cornell Dining employees who did a fantastic job working in this sort of product development stage where everything needs to be recorded very meticulously. Because of these items have a 2-day shelf life on them, we have to make sure that the stability is good on the product, and we have to keep revisiting if things are going a little bit sideways to stabilize the product. But it's a clean product, it's a great product, and we tried to hit all the different areas, right? So we have chicken parmesan, so we hit some Italian, we have some Mexican stuff, we have some southern cuisine, and also the healthy stuff. We have lots of grains and tofu that's a vegan Southwest style grain bowl. So as we worked through the summer, it was a lot of work to, as Dustin said, we had a figure out what was the best packaging. We really came up with some wonderful packaging that heats the product nicely, which only takes roughly 3 minutes. You can see here, these are the products that are plated. So it shows the food, and it's really a great portion of the product, and everything is made fresh daily. We do our breaded chicken cutlets from scratch. We cook all our fresh vegetables and pastas and sauces. Everything is made from scratch. We hope you enjoy this product. I think it's a real bargain. If you transfer it out onto your plate at home, you'll be like, wow, that's a lot of food. it is good for children. There's a mac and cheese aspect, and we drilled in about 25% cauliflower. So I challenge you to see if you can locate it, because we kind of swirl it in there, toddler style. You know, I'm like, hey, this is delicious. And we try to put the vegetable forward portion of it in there as well. So I hope you get a chance to try this product, because I think you'll enjoy it. And I think we'll have some other ones coming down the pipe maybe at some point in the future once we work out all our logistics, moving the product in and around campus. Questions, anybody? Yes.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I'd love to get the word out to our constituencies within facilities and campus services about this. Is there a website that we direct people to about this and where they find them and all of those things? Is that
so? What we can do is, Karen, do you know who Karen Brown is?
Yeah.
She's our Director of Marketing and Communications.
Yes.
And she's working on an email blast right now that
okay.
we can provide you that you can send out to your listeners.
Awesome.
So if you could just reach out to Karen and see
okay.
where she's at with that, or I can
great.
Have her follow up with you as well.
That'd be great.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I'd love to let you.
Well, I was just curious. I'm a celiac. I have to be gluten-free. It's
yeah.
a medical necessity, not
yeah.
an option. Are
yeah.
any of the options gluten-free?
The grain bowl is gluten-free.
What kind of grains is it?
There's buckwheat, quinoa, lentils. Yep. It's not produced in a gluten-free
right.
facility, but all the ingredients are gluten-free. Any questions? Yeah.
Quick question about the packaging. I don't see it here, but I noticed that you said it's heatable and all that. It's you know,
yes.
friendly. But how environmentally friendly is it? Is there a lot of plastic? I mean, how much of that?
It is a polyethylene tray, which is a microwave safe tray. I believe it has recyclable aspects to it.
It's fully recyclable, but it is made out of plastic at this point in time with the best packaging that we could find. But it is microwaveable safe. That's what I said that probably.
Yes.
Okay.
And last question, Ellen.
First of all, I'm very excited about this. I can't wait to do it because I hate cooking. Can you guys do it for us? Do the packages contain nutrition information?
You can go through online through Net Nutrition, and you can see that. That should be up probably in another week or two, and you can see that.
It does list allergens.
Okay.
So the ingredient statement has the allergens on it, yes.
Yeah. And we're also thinking about as this program continues to grow, and I'm just really quickly, we plan on getting some reusable bags that people can, if they want to come purchase like 3 or 4, so that they can come with a bag and use that and kind of be part of a take us home club, kind of like we have coffee clubs around campus as well. So we look forward to expanding the product line a little bit, and as well some of the locations once we start seeing what participation looks like with the program.
Thank you guys very much.
Thanks
for you all being here. I'm sorry.
I just one quick question. What does success look like to you guys? If we push this out and we get an overwhelming response, how much are you anticipating? How can we best work with you?
Well, we're pretty happy with the start at this point, and we'll just have to add some labor to that. That's really what would make that.
If we push this out and you guys get a huge response, that's a good thing.
Yes, yes, and we will respond in kind and produce that product, yeah. And the grain bowl is numero uno, and it's just filling it. So,
nice.
Yeah, so
try
the,
that one.
The vegan, vegetarian, obviously, and the gluten-free bowl is the number one seller out of all.
Thank you both very much.
Okay, thank you.
Due to the fact that we are out of time, I will say that our next meeting next week, we have 45 minutes with Mary and Reginald. After that, though, we will go in directly into committee reports. One thing that I would ask to think about between now and next week, Hey and I have been thinking about some just random low-cost ways to potentially connect with our second and third shift employees. And one of the ideas with a requirement, I'll be brief. We'd like to do like a dish to pass and potentially have each committee take on one dish to pass, take it out to a second and third shift police department, out to the vet school, our building care, dining facility folks. And we're thinking of just a low-cost way that we leave a note, say, this is from the employee assembly, we care about what you all are doing, and oh, by the way, here's a stamp addressed return envelope with some questions. Tell us how things are going. Let us know. And those will be mailed to the Office of Assemblies, and then we could another way to kind of get some feedback. So think about that. If that's something you'd like us to pursue, we would try to find some potential budget support through the EA and go from there. I hope all of you have a wonderful afternoon, and we will see you next week. The meeting is adjourned.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.